let's get started with a whole bunch of stuff here today. This is a kind of an exciting time between Christmas and New Year's. There's a lot of things, a lot of possibilities on the table, a lot of things that we could talk about. And I've got a long list of things that I want to talk about. One of them is the dangers of owning a car. It turns out that we're all worried about cell phones and tracking on the internet, and it turns out that some research was done. The Washington Post did an article where they basically hacked a car to find out how much the car knew about the driver, and this is really, really fascinating stuff, so we'll talk about that for sure. There's a new law in California that's going to kick in January, January 1, that has people, the big tech companies kind of scrambling, and it looks like, for the most part, it's going to be ignored. The law is going to be ignored, so we're going to have to see how that plays out. It's going to be interesting. There are a number of security things to talk about and review. And, you know, this is the time of year where we talk about New Year's resolutions and so forth. So we'll talk about those as well. If you have a New Year's resolution, I'd love to hear about it. This is The Pilgrim Show. We're on Freedomizer Radio. And ordinarily, the phone number we'll call would be 319-527-6208. This is a pre-recorded show, however. Being between Christmas and New Year's, there was a family get together that I could not step away from or skip, so I wouldn't want to do that just for the show. So recording this here early in the morning Saturday, and I'll make the podcast version available at GuruPilgrim.com, but also I'll go ahead and add that into the regular show time Saturday on FreedomizerRadio.com, and that'll be Saturday 4:30. Eastern Time, 1:30 Pacific. We run the show for 90 minutes, and I try to pack as much into that 90 minutes as possible. This is a time of year when we talk about New Year's resolutions, and it's sort of a fading tradition. It used to be that New Year's resolutions were what people did. It's just it was more common. And it seems to be more and more people are just ignoring it. And there are a number of reasons. I'd like to talk about that a little bit because I think it's an interesting indicator to our society and where we're headed as a country and as a society. The biggest thing is people don't keep them anymore. So people get all excited about the New Year's resolution and they try to do it, and then they fail. So if you do that enough of times, it becomes easier just to give up and to say, well, you know, I can't do the New Year's resolution thing. And that sort of is a window into what's going on in society, where I think there's less and less follow-through. It seems almost like we've forgotten what it means to accomplish things, to get things done. It reminds me of the movie WALL-E, where, you know, all the people are up in space, and they're just sitting on their couches and so forth, riding around on these machines, and they never have to do any work. And everybody gets fat and lazy, and because they forgot what it means to accomplish things. They forgot what it means to feel the breeze, to wake up and smell the coffee, to do things for each other, or to get things done. What does that accomplishment feel like? And more, that's the way that we are as a society. We have everything handed to us. We don't really have to do much work anymore. To the point that when you look at cars, for example, which we're going to talk about cars are changing, and they're changing pretty drastically. And one of the reasons they're changing is because people aren't interested in the car anymore. They just want something that's going to be comfortable and get them to their destination with tech. See, they have to have tech all the time. People are surrounded by tech, and they have to have this, you know, the more technology-centric, whatever they're interacting in, is, the more they like it. People are just consumed by this idea of, well, tech can just make my life easier. And you know, I'm convinced, and this is a theory of mine, but I'm convinced that the ancient cultures of the world understood the danger of too much technology. Because what would happen is, when one culture conquered another culture, they would not adopt all the technology of that culture like we do today. When was the last time you heard of a nation uncovering another nation's tech and saying, oh, well, we need to destroy this. This is theirs. And it's not how they think today. Today, if a nation discovers another nation's tech, they want to keep it. They want to reverse engineer it and use it themselves. Even the United States does this with other nations' tech. Okay. So why was it then that in hundreds and thousands of years ago, when a nation conquered another nation, the first thing they did was destroy all of their technology? I think there's more to it than just a social paradigm. I think it's really an understanding of the dangers of too much tech. Now, I say this as a technologist. I love technology. I work with technology. Every day, this is my job. This is what I do for a living. So, you might say, well, that's very bizarre to diss technology like this when this is what I do for a living. And people have been confused by that. I try to explain that really the more that I am in control of the technology that I use, the more comfortable I am with it. And this is why I've had a fear of cars, of new cars, because not because they're not comfortable, or it's the security concern and the privacy concern. But we're going to get to that a little bit later in the show. I have some more thoughts here about this whole follow-through, this idea of follow-through. And maybe let's see if we could figure out a little bit more about what's happening to us. There's another thing that hit me just yesterday. I was working and was unscrewing something, and it was a flathead. And, you know, I found myself enjoying using a flathead screwdriver. And I felt like I had to tell this story today. I'm probably more excited to tell this story than I should be. This is actually, I don't know why, but I'm fascinated by this thing. I used to hate flathead screws and flathead screwdrivers. And I think a lot of people probably do. When anybody that uses a wrench and a screwdriver on a regular basis today, it seems like hates flathead screwdrivers and flathead screws. Now, why in the world do these things exist? Well, I remember once, I don't remember where I was, who I was talking to. I was complaining about a flathead screwdriver. I was like, why? Who in the world? Who in their right mind invented this thing? You know, this is just, it's dumb. And they said to me, they said, well, flathead screws don't strip as easy. And it hit me, and I was like, wait, there's a reason for these things? See, the problem is, when you use a flathead screw, a screwdriver, you put it in there, and it always keeps slipping out. It slips off to the side, and then you have to, like, keep repositioning the screwdriver. And we're so impatient in this culture and in this age that we don't want to do that anymore. A Phillips head, you just put the end of the screwdriver in there, and you don't have to worry about whether it slips out. You just kind of spin it there, and it's fine. You don't have to think about what you're doing. You just do it. And that is where we are. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to have to actually take time to do something right or to do something effective. And the flathead screw is a great example. The reason that they were made in the first place, first of all, they're more practical. If you can use you can use anything to turn it. You can use a pocket knife to turn it. So it's a little bit more practical. It's also doesn't strip as easy. It's easier to make. To make a flathead screw head, all you have to do is just cut a slit in it. That's all you got to do. One, and you're done. Whereas a Phillips, you have to have some sort of a cutter to cut it in the right way. So this is where we are. And, you know, it kind of leads me to this thing, what makes us this way? Why is society changing in this way? And it's absolutely about the captivity of technology. As I was saying earlier, there is so much focus on the necessity of the tech. We have to have this tech. I have to have this, this new phone, and we can't leave the house without the phone. It's really changing the way that we live. And this was really cool. There was a Slashdot post that I just have to point out and read, because this was really cool. A university teacher challenged his students to turn in their cell phones for 9 days. And then write about living without them. And all he was offering was extra credit. He couldn't, take their phones. But what he did was he offered them extra credit if they would turn in their phones for 9 days. And here's what the response was. Here's one of the students, quote, "Believe it or not, I had to walk up to a stranger and ask what time it was. It honestly took me a lot of guts and confidence to ask someone." So, asking somebody what time it is. Now, you would think, here's what's going through her mind. She says, "Well, why do you?" Maybe they'll say, "Well, why do you need to ask me the time? Everyone has a cell phone. You must be weird or something." So, if you don't have a cell phone, see, here's the thing. If you don't have your cell phone on you and you have to ask someone else for the time, then you are weird. And it's outside of the social norm. And so this would be foreign. Another student says, "Simply walking by strangers in the hallway or when I pass them on the street caused almost all of them to take out their phone right before I could gain eye contact with them." This is at a university, so probably most of the people she was passing were other students or young people. And this is the generation that is being raised now. This is the generation that's taking on the world. There's a group of people who literally cannot make eye contact with a stranger because it's awkward. They never do it. They have never had to do it. And if they walk by somebody that doesn't have a cell phone, well, then that's weird. And they pull out their phone, and that way they don't have to make eye contact. It has become a comfort zone. Pulling out your phone and looking at it has become a reflex frankly, I have actually caught myself doing that. Pulling out my phone and saying, let me check my phone when I'm in an awkward situation. And that's dangerous, I think. What are you doing? I mean, it's a defense mechanism. Well, see, I'm doing this thing. It's kind of like taking a drink of water, taking a glass of water and taking a drink of it at a time when you're trying to... That used to be the way you would defer, but now it's you pull out your cell phone. Which is immensely more consuming. Here, I'll continue reading the article here. It says, "To these young people, direct, unmediated human contact was experienced as ill-mannered ill-mannered at best and strange at worst." Here's another student. He says, "One of the worst and most common things people do nowadays is pull out their cell phones and use it while in a face-to-face conversation. This action is very rude and unacceptable, but yet again, I find myself guilty of it sometimes because it is the norm." It is now normal. And for a lot of these young people, this is day-to-day, where they will be across from another person, face-to-face, and they will be using their cell phone in that conversation. They'll be standing there looking at the other person and they've got their cell phone out. Another student says a lot of people used their cell phones when they felt they were in an awkward situation. For example, being at a party while no one was speaking to them. The price of this protection from awkward moments is the loss of human relationships, a consequence that almost all the students identified and lamented. I talked to teachers at elementary level on a regular basis as part of my job. First grade teachers, kindergarten teachers, have said to me that in recent years, children are not learning each other's names. They come into the school, they've got a class full of students, and it's half the year before they learn each other's names. And they said this has never been the case, but now it's normal. But what's happening is we're pulling ourselves away more and more from real interaction with each other, and more the technology, the virtual world, is the place where we interact. If you're going to have New Year's resolution, I think I know what it should be. Less time on the cell phone. I don't know how to make that work, but you've got to figure that out for yourself. But I really think that is something we should think about as a society. Here's another student. Being forced to have real relationships with people obviously made me a better person, because each time it happened, I learned how to deal with the situation better, other than sticking my face in my phone. 10 out of the 12 students said their phones were compromising their ability to have such relationships. We are literally, not figuratively, we are literally losing our ability to be a society. And there are dangers here beyond just our interactions with each other. The virtual world is not a perfect place. It's not a utopia. We may feel it's like a utopia, and the reason that we're drawn to it is the feeling that it gives us. It gives us a feeling. We're drawn to the world. The gaming is a prime example of this. There are people that are sucked into games so much so that they can't function outside of the game. Human beings are very moldable. We can be changed. We can be influenced. We can find ourselves in a different paradigm and really adapt to it well. You could throw a person into a completely different culture and give them a couple of weeks, and they would be just right at home. The human mind is really, really moldable. But what happens is we mold it to a virtual reality, a false reality, a place that doesn't really exist. And we find gratification in that reality. We find comfort in that reality. And this is what we're attaching ourselves to. How much can a person learn? How fast can a person learn? What can a person do with their lives when they're so tied to this virtual reality? I would venture to say that success in life is going to be more difficult for these people. I really think it will. I think it will actually be more difficult. The dangers, just as an example, there are American universities now using a social credit system to track students. So what they're doing is it's like an opt-in thing. And there's an article here from the Daily Caller that I'll link to in the show notes at gurupilgrim.com. And also at freedomizerradio.com, there's show notes there as well. And these American universities are using a system for points. They give it, it's a social credit system. So the university will award them points based on certain behaviors. But the students have to opt in. Now, what does that do? The students are opting in to allowing the university to track their movement and track things about their activities from their phone. They install an app. The app tracks their activities. They go here, they go there, they do this, they do that. And a spokesperson for one of the universities says the students want these points. The students really desire to have, this is a great opportunity. They want the points. So we're going to captivate on that. And give them the option to have those points. And as a result, these universities are able to track students' behavior and see more things about them than ever imagined, and they're volunteering it. And if you were to introduce this, here's the crazy thing. If you were to introduce this kind of a program 15 years ago, it would have been a huge deal. And people would have said, no, never, this will never happen to our society. And here we are. We are becoming more and more immune to the loss of privacy because this virtual world that we find ourselves living in, so to speak, is more important to us than the other, than real life. So we don't really need, we don't need our privacy because we have the comfort of this false reality. So that's where we're headed, and it's kind of a scary place. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my New Year's resolutions later on in the program, some of the things that I want to do. And the big thing is follow through. We don't follow through because we've given up on this idea of accomplishing things for ourselves. But I want to try to break that down and beat it down. And so I've got some things that I'm going to be doing this year. We're going to definitely talk about the car incident with the privacy concerns with the car. There was a little bit, believe it or not, of news over the Christmas break. Hong Kong continued their protest. There were people out there on Christmas Day protesting. Now, I don't know much of the history here, so I can't say that I know that the Chinese people don't really celebrate Christmas, and so it could be the case that Hong Kongers also don't celebrate Christmas. I'm not sure, but December 25th, it looks like there were some injuries and some people out there protesting and some serious stuff. And we had also a really fascinating thing. Let me just talk about this really quick. There were more than 100 Chinese nationals arrested in Nepal for a suspected cyber scam. So Nepal police arrested more than 100 Chinese nationals over a suspected cyber scam. Now, this was the largest ever operation involving foreigners in Nepal. And basically, this is how a lot of these scams work. You have people just kind of work together in cubicles, and they have like a laptop or a desktop, and then they make phone calls from these computers and scam people over the internet. And this is what sounds like this was. Authorities raided 9 houses in the capital earlier this week. And police said houses were set up like hostels with large kitchens, bunk beds, and rows of tables and chairs for working. So very, very just kind of scattered and just kind of put together on a whim. They were suspected in a cyber crime. Police estimate that more than 700 mobile phones, 331 laptops, and nearly 100 desktop computers were taken, and along with pen drives and SIM cards. These Chinese nationals were actually on tourist visas, and so they weren't even supposed to be doing anything really effectively in the country other than tourism, which they weren't doing. So this was kind of a big deal. It was actually a really good thing. Often these sorts of scams go on and on and on. In this case, I think because they were in another country illegally, basically, it made it easier to catch them. So that is something that went on. When we get back, we're going to talk about some other things. We're going to talk about some mystery drones over Colorado. That's an interesting story as well. And there's a lot of stuff to go over, so we will take a short break and be back here in just a moment.
Please check out the Barefoot is Legal radio show right here on Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, that is 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific Time, as we show you all about your barefoot rights and living a barefoot lifestyle. And for more information about the 501c3 nonprofit Barefoot is Legal, please check out barefootislegal.org.
Earthing, also known as grounding, is the act of touching our body's skin directly to the earth, just like our ancestors did as they slept, sat, and walked on the ground nearly every day of their lives. This simple connection allows Earth's natural negative electrons to enter the human body, pacifying dangerous free radicals, which, if left unchecked, can cause severe damage to cells that can lead to many chronic diseases. Ground Therapy's patented process and suite of products were designed for you to experience all the benefits of grounding in your busy and modern lifestyle. And you'll experience the benefits of grounding within the safety and comfort of your home or office throughout the entire day, just as if you were touching the earth itself.
The information is provided for general.
I'd like to tell you about the open source tool that I use the most. It's not LibreOffice, and it's not some fancy IDE. It's actually Inkscape. That's right, the vector graphics editor. I use this tool for everything, from custom graphics to presentation slides. Occasionally, I'll even use it in place of publishing software. Why do I make so much use of Inkscape, you ask? Unlike some open source tools, the feature set that Inkscape touts is almost directly comparable to its expensive closed source alternatives. Like any software, it can take some getting used to. But with all the tools in easy-to-find places, it may be the fastest way to get started with vector graphics. Vector graphics are a kind of graphics that use points on a graph to draw lines and shapes, which makes them infinitely scalable without distortion. With a variety of grid, snapping, and alignment tools, Inkscape gives you precise control over every part of your art and opens the door to all kinds of possibilities. Install it for free. Visit Inkscape.org to learn more.
Hey everyone, come check out the Proof Negative radio show here on FreedomizerRadio.com, Monday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the Pacific Coast as we fight the New World Order and rock the health freedom world together.
Okay, one more time. This is your foot. This is shoes. This is your foot in shoes.
I can't move.
Any questions?
A little help.
This public service announcement brought to you by Zero Shoes. Feel the freedom, feel the fun, feel the world in Zero Shoes.
Please check out the Barefoot is Legal radio show right here on Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, that is 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific Time, as we show you all about your barefoot rights and living a barefoot lifestyle. And for more information about the 501c3 nonprofit Barefoot is Legal, please check out barefootislegal.org.
Did you know that every time you swipe your debit card, those behind-the-scenes transaction fees make the big banks even richer? In 2016 alone, these fees added up to $60 billion. Yes, that's billion with a B. Well, what if there was a way to have the convenience of a debit card, but reroute those fees from the banksters to organizations actually doing good in the world? Organizations that protect the environment or feed hungry children? What if your swipes could literally change the world? Well, Groundswell SPC has found a way to do just that. We've designed a Visa debit card program that shares transaction fees with your favorite cause. Groundswell partners with nonprofit organizations that promote the card to their supporters. Their supporters then use the card to power the mission of the nonprofit. It's a win-win-win for everyone, except the big banks, of course. Groundswell is about to launch its first cards into market, and we're inviting you to be part of this movement as an investor in the company. Go to WeFunder.com/groundswellcard to learn more. Set up a free WeFunder account and invest in Groundswell today and get your money on mission.
Future for the country. Let's talk about the future. So the first thing, we have news resolutions that we talked about a little bit, and I don't know if you have any New Year's resolutions. I have decided on a couple of things, and one of them is just an experiment that I'm going to do with languages. Who knows how long it's going to last. You know, I say, you know, follow through, and I make this big spiel and all this, but I tend to be the kind of personality who moves from one thing to another, a victim of this fast-moving society, and so who knows if I'm going to be able to stick with this or not. I'm as much a victim of the technology that I try to, as much as I have this whole philosophy about not being influenced by it, I'm quite a victim of it, I do believe. Anyways, so one of the things is an experiment in learning languages, and as the guru pilgrim, what else would I do, right? There are limits to learning language, and what I find with myself is I come across languages on the internet, and I come across things, and I say, man, if only I could like at least read what I'm seeing. You know, the Slavic languages are fascinating to me. Most of the Latin origin languages are fascinating to me. One of my favorites is Inuktitut, which would be the Eskimos in northern Canada. They have their own writing system. It looks pretty daunting. It looks like something out of a science fiction novel. It's really a really cool language, and it's a native language, so it has some of those characteristics where you know, you'll have a word that has prefixes and suffixes that creates the sentence. So that's a really cool language. Korean is fascinating, mostly for the Hangul, but also just as a language. So these are different things that I'm curious about. And so I've picked seven that I want some more exposure to. Now, they say you can only learn four languages at a time. And I'll be honest, I'm not really attempting to learn these languages. I just want some exposure to them. I don't expect to be able to speak them. I don't expect to be able to really understand everything I read, but in 2020, the year of clarity, as I call it, because 2020 vision, so it's the year of clarity, I have this desire to become more familiar, get some exposure to these seven languages, and just to a level where when I see one, I can recognize it and identify a few words, and maybe even get a little bit of the gist of what's going on. So let's talk about learning languages, because languages are fun. And pushing the limits of that. How many words do you have? This was a question I have. How many words do you have to have in a language to be able to be fluent? Well, it turns out there's quite a bit of research on this, and there are different numbers and thresholds that will really help you sort of work your way up. And in fact, there's this thing called the Common European Framework of Reference for Languages. And this common reference comes with levels. There's an A, a B, and a C. A would be a basic user, B would be an independent user, and C would be a proficient user. And then for each of those, there's a 1 and a 2. So there's an A1 and an A2. And there's a B1 and a B2, and a C1 and a C2. So C2 is mastery or proficiency. Essentially, C2 is all but, you may not be a native speaker, but a C2 is somebody who could almost be passed off as a native speaker of that language. Really fully gets it, speaks with fluent, doesn't really worry about what, understands all of the nuances of the words and so forth that he's using. That is a C2 level. of a language. So how many words is that? Roughly 10,000 plus words. When you hit 10,000 words in a language, you can really hit that C2 level. Now, some languages are less. Some apparently are as low as 4,000. 4,000 words before you hit that. But generally speaking, this is what we're talking about. 10,000 words. But C2 is pretty daunting. And you don't get there overnight, and you don't get there without being submersed in language. That's one of the ways of learning language. There are different ways of learning languages. Let's talk about that a little bit. You could just pick up a book and read the guide. And this is what happens in high school. We get exposed to a language, and it's like a workbook. And you might have a teacher that speaks it. But essentially, you get a few words, you get some basic grammar, you understand like sort of how words are put together. Usually, you don't learn anything about accent, so you basically speak it with a completely English accent. And you don't really retain it, at least unless you're really dedicated. And there are students that go into those and come out the other side, and they really know how to converse a little bit. But generally, they're not super effective. Those kinds of interactions with language. The other kind of thing is self-study, where you use apps. Here we go, leveraging technology. But there are a lot of really good apps that help you to learn faster. And I think they're generally not too dangerous. I'm sure there's tracking in some of them, but not a big deal. You learn these languages, and with this, if you have a self-paced goal of saying, I really want to do this, and you listen to internet radio is a big way, and find podcasts that are interesting, start interacting online in that language, that those are the ways that you can really start to quickly self-teach and do those things. And then there's submersion, and nothing beats it. If you go to a country where you are surrounded by only that language, and especially when there's places where nobody speaks English, you really find yourself forced to really start interacting in that language, and you can learn it much, much faster and with much better accuracy in full immersion. There are actually programs, depending on what language you're looking for, definitely this happens in French in the United States, where you can find a group that will just get together and speak in French, and really just to help each other learn it. The caveat there is most of them are not native speakers, so you could have some issues with that. But at least it's a place where you can try submersion without actually traveling to another country. Obviously, if you're in Canada, you can probably find some people who speak French. And, of course, with Spanish, that's the other thing, too. In the States, there are generally communities of Spanish-speaking people. You could certainly open up to them and see about just trying to learn Spanish that way. So it depends on what language you're looking to learn. For me, I've picked Catalan, French, Russian, Ukrainian, Inuktitut, Korean, and Hebrew. That's what I want to dabble in. We'll see. I don't know if it's going to last for all of 2020 or not, but here's my plan. 30 words a day. What I'm going to shoot for is concept learning rather than, like, a concept-based strategy rather than a goal-based strategy. So if you're learning more than one language at a time, learning the same word for the same concept in multiple languages is definitely the way to go. Because you're focused on that one concept. At least, now, I say this before I try the experiment, so I should be careful what I say. But the thinking that I have is, if you focus on, let's say, numbers, right? You take numbers, and you start to count in each of these languages. And one day you take numbers. Now, there's about 30 words to cover the spectrum of numbers, because counting uses a lot of repetition. So with about 30 words, you can get all the numbers. With about 30 words, you can get a good number of colors. With about 30 words, you can get some general food words. You know, without about 30 words, you can learn the body parts that you're going to refer to. Same with like a lot of different things. So 30 is a great number if you want to really kind of move quickly. And again, for me, I'm not trying to memorize all of these words in a day. I'm just trying to get exposure to 30 words in a day. But what I'll do is I'll pick a topic. Right now it's greetings, because that's where you start. Greetings. Hello, how are you? I'm fine. My name is, your name is, those kinds of things. And so the 30 of those that I've got, I learn in one language, and then I learn in another language, and then I learn in another language, and then another language, all the way through 7 languages. What's cool about that is it's the same concept. And what I've learned is, in the past, if you are, once you exercise your mind in a particular group of ideas, once you exercise your mind and say, in greetings, and you've learned greetings in 3 languages already, then learning greetings in a 4th becomes easier, because your mind has been exercised in that topic and can go a little further. The problem is retaining more than 4 languages new is supposed to be impossible. You're not supposed to be able to do that. So, let's see. How many words do you need? Well, there's an article here from Fluento.com that says that a functional beginner can really start to have basic everyday conversations with 250 to 500 words. That's pretty quick. You don't have to do a whole lot. I mean, if you get the greetings, you get the colors, you get the directions, you get the basic adjectives, a few nouns, you can really start to communicate with people. Obviously, prepositions are really important, and some basic sentence structure and grammar. So there's not like a whole lot. To get to this initial like threshold of just basic interaction with people is not too difficult. You can hit 250 to 500 words in a week if you work at it, at a particular language, or a couple of weeks if you pace yourself. So that's a relatively reachable goal. And hitting that with 7 languages shouldn't be too difficult. Conversational, though, you get to 1,000 words, and you could start to have some conversations about everyday life. And that is a really, really important place to be, especially if you're going to be going to a country where they don't speak English. Because here now you can talk about your situation, about transit, about getting around, and really be able to get directions from somebody. These are important things, and you'll be able to do that with about 1,000 words in a language. Once you hit that 3,000 word threshold, you really start to be able to use the language. And I mean really use it. And they say that, you know, with 5,000 words, you can really work in a business situation. You can do your job and be expected to perform with about 5,000 words of language and really have it at that point. And then that real fluency comes with about 10,000 words. So there's your markers, there's your points of things. Now, for 30 words in a day, if I expose myself to 30 words in a day on an average of 5 days a week, because there's going to be days that it's not going to work or whatever, and I may not always do it on the weekends or whatever, the math adds up to 7,800 words that I would be exposing myself to within a year. 7,800. So if it were one language, I would be exposed to enough words that I'd be in a really good place. Now, immersion, you actually can learn that fast, because in immersion, you can pick up a lot of words that you don't even realize you're picking up, and you learn them by interacting with them in a context, and that's the key. Having a context to use each word in is the real key. I remember in studying Catalan and Spanish in the past, the easiest set of words that I learned was the body parts, the finger, the hand, the face, the nose, the eyes, the ears. And the reason is they were with me all the time. So in a matter of a couple of hours, I learned all of those words because I could tangibly touch my finger and say, this is a finger, you know, this is a dit. And I've got it, you know, I have this word, and I know it now. Because there was a context to put it into. And this is the key, this is what I'm really trying to do, is getting the context. So for numbers, count everything. For that week and a half, I'm going to be counting everything in whatever language happens to be my language for the day. And just try to really internalize those numbers because of using them and really having a context around them. And that'll just help me to retain a little bit of that. So it really kind of depends on your goals. What are you trying to accomplish with language and so forth? This would be a great thing to use as a New Year's resolution if you want to try to follow through and actually do something. It's interesting that in the United States, people can be literally never exposed to another language. If you think about it, English is everywhere. You can get on the internet and use only English and only ever get English results. I would venture to say it is possible that that is impossible in any other language. If you speak Thai, for example, you are going to come across English pages on the internet. Probably almost without exception. I mean, you're gonna Google something, you're gonna end up hitting English pages. Even if you're in Thailand. Now, I might be wrong about that. I'd be really curious. So if you've been to Thailand and you've Googled a lot of things, I would love to hear from you. But this is a unique place in the world where the whole internet is built around English. Programming languages are built around English. Answers to questions are written primarily in English. And then there are other languages, but when you Google something, it will translate, it'll find what you're looking for in English, regardless of what language you use. And it'll return English results. And this is the world we live in. So I am incredibly happy that English is my native language. I would be lost without it. If it were another language, there are so many things that I wouldn't be able to be effective in if English weren't my first language. But for a lot of places, anywhere else you go in the world, English is not the only language. And you're going to be interacting with other people in other languages. And, you know, there really are a lot of great minds out there on the internet and around the world. And those great minds are great people that have great content. And I want to interact with them. And it's a little bit difficult when, you know, you can't even read the writing system that they use. So that is all very real. California is introducing a new law limiting the sale of user data. Now, this affects big tech companies. This is, it's called CCPA. I don't know why it says PA, because that reminds me of Pennsylvania. I don't actually know what this is about. Let's see. What is CCPA? Maybe it tells me here. Oh, California Consumer Privacy Act. Yeah, Consumer Privacy Act. So the gist, as I understand it, is that California is requiring companies who sell personal data to other companies to inform the user that they have sold said data. It says here in this one article, it says users must also have access to their data and be able to request that a company delete it, better known as the right to be forgotten. That's kind of hilarious. There is no constitutional right of privacy in the United States. So we don't have the right of privacy in the United States, surprisingly. This would seem like something that would be pretty important, but it's not there. So we don't have a right to be forgotten, but it's pretty cool that some people think we do, because I think it's important. I think it would be really valuable to be forgotten, to have the right to be forgotten. However, California is the first to pass this kind of a law, but the tech company's reaction to it is really the interesting thing. There's a story here from Breitbart that Facebook and Uber plan to defy the new law, taking effect in January 2020. Pardon me, I have coffee this morning. It's wonderful coffee. Monsoon Malabar. They leave this coffee beans, these coffee beans, they take the coffee cherries off the tree, and they leave them in, they put them in like, the only word that comes to mind is cages. They're not cages, like net kind of things out in the wind. They let the monsoons come through and clean off the cherries and basically process the beans for them. And what that does then is it pulls out, because the beans soak in the water and the wind and so forth, it pulls the acidity out of the bean without pulling the flavor out of the bean, at least in theory, and just wonderful coffee. Great taste, no acidity, which I could really use. Anyway, California's law here. So Facebook is going to just ignore it. And the reason that they give is basically that they aren't selling the data, which I think in a court of law they might have some trouble with. Maybe they aren't. Maybe they're not selling the data. Maybe they're just using the data themselves. And they're... it's kind of hard. Facebook is claiming, here from Breitbart, that routine data transfers may not fit the state's definition of selling data. Internet companies, including major social networks and search engines, routinely gather user information and share them, usually without disclosing these actions to customers. The nonprofit digital rights group Electronic Frontier Foundation released a study showing that popular sites share the user data they collect with third-party businesses, including data brokers, advertisers, and government bodies. Uber is planning to flout a different California law that would reclassify its army of drivers from contractors to employees, potentially entitling them to benefits and perks. The ride-sharing company is joining forces with Lyft and DoorDash to mount a $90 million counteroffensive against the new law, which takes effect in January. Can you imagine if every time you went on the internet, you landed on a new link, you clicked a button, you opened a new website, you were informed of all of the information that that website collected about you? And who it was going to be shared with. Can you even imagine what that would look like? It would almost become overwhelming. You would maybe never use the internet again, I'm not sure. Lawyers for Uber are urging that the law doesn't apply to the company because drivers' work falls, quote, outside of usual course of Uber's business, which they define as providing a technology platform. Yeah, see, Uber is a technology company, it's not a transportation company. So the law regarding technology and collection of data doesn't apply to them? I'm not sure how that works, but okay. The so-called gig worker law, formerly known as AB5, has already impacted Vox Media, which recently laid off hundreds of freelance journalists who would have been reclassified as employees under the new law. So there's an interesting dynamic between government and big brother, big data or big brother, which is really curious. Why it's this way, it's kind of surprising, and it can only happen in a free country. If this were Russia or North Korea, the technology would be used only by the government. Oh, wait, it is. That's kind of how it works, isn't it, in those places? Big Brother is government. All of the big data is owned by the government. All the big, you get on your cell phone and you use a service for a cloud, you're storing your stuff in the government's servers. That's essentially how it works. I mean, not exactly, but the government has backdoors to every big business in Russia, as I understand it. Any communist country, this is going to be the way it is. You put a big firewall of China, you know, there and prevent anybody from getting in or out without your consent, without your monitoring it. In the United States, Big Brother is the people, so to speak. Big Brother is the people who have the service to offer. So you could become Big Brother. If you decide one day you want to build a platform that beats out Facebook and social media, you develop a new Snapchat kind of a platform, you just build it yourself, but you become bigger than Facebook and you don't sell out to them. That's the other thing. The big ones that are there now could just buy you up like nobody's business, and you'd be hard-pressed not to sell. Because you'd have to have lawyers and all this, and they would shoot you down. But if you were able to do it, you could do it. It's the land of the free. It's the land of the pursuit of happiness. And you could become a Big Brother if you wanted to. So these big data companies are really capitalizing on this opportunity that they have. We are, I just looked at the clock, we are out of time for this segment. There's a lot more to come, and so we're going to wrap it up here and be back just in a minute.
Hey everyone, come check out the Proof Negative Radio Show here on FreedomizerRadio.com, Monday through Thursday, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the Pacific Coast as we fight the New World Order and rock the health freedom world together.
Earthing, also known as grounding, is the act of touching our body's skin directly to the earth, just like our ancestors did as they slept, sat, and walked on the ground nearly every day of their lives. This simple connection allows Earth's natural negative electrons to enter the human body, pacifying dangerous free radicals, which, if left unchecked, can cause severe damage to cells that can lead to many chronic diseases. Ground Therapy's patented process and suite of products were designed for you to experience all the benefits of grounding in your busy and modern lifestyle. And you'll experience the benefits of grounding within the safety and comfort of your home or office throughout the entire day, just as if you were touching the earth itself.
The information is provided for general informational purposes only. The contents are not intended or implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Ground Therapy Incorporated makes no representations about the efficiency, appropriateness, or suitability of any specific tests, procedures, treatments, services, opinions, healthcare providers, or other information that may be contained in or available through the information provided.
Please check out the Barefoot is Legal radio show right here on Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, that is 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific Time, as we show you all about your barefoot rights and living a barefoot lifestyle. And for more information about the 501c3 nonprofit Barefoot is Legal, please check out barefootislegal.org. Please check out the Barefoot is Legal radio show right here on Saturdays, 1:30 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, that is 10:30 a.m. to noon Pacific Time, as we show you all about your barefoot rights and living a barefoot lifestyle. And for more information about the 501c3 nonprofit Barefoot is Legal, please check out barefootislegal.org.
Show, and I'm the Guru Pilgrim, Nate Moss, and as always, the thoughts and opinions expressed on the show do not reflect those of my employer, and any advice that I give, use at your own risk. Security rundown here, there are five stories on my deck. We have a flaw in Google Chrome that got a name. It has actually it's a set of five flaws. There's been a number of stories around it. And in fact, as I look at this now, I was wrong. It's not five stories, it's two, because this one has two cards in my deck. The Google Chrome Magellan, is that how you say it? M-A-G-E-L-L-A-N. Magellan? I guess that's it. Magellan 2.0. Magellan 2.0. It's a SQLite vulnerability, set of 5 vulnerabilities that can result in remote code execution. Sounds like basically it allows you to corrupt system files. And if you were to able to corrupt those system files in a particular way, you might be able to leverage that to run remote code of your choosing. Basically, this just means that we need to update our Chrome browsers immediately. There are CVEs listed here. This is a pretty big one. So if you use Chrome, please update. NVIDIA. So if you're a gamer and you are on Windows and you use the GeForce Experience provided by NVIDIA, there's a high severity flaw that they just released a fix for. If you are a Linux user like myself, generally these don't affect you, and it looks like this is one of those cases. The reason I bring this one up is that it's got a base score of 8.4 out of 10 for severity. So that's pretty big. This is a great great time of year to release a bug like this, and I don't know if this was, I don't think this was a zero day, but a bunch of people are just getting their new games out and got some games for Christmas, probably playing them, and turns out they've got a security vulnerability in their graphics driver. So if you use that on Windows, if you use GeForce Experience, might be time to update. This was a big one here, critical bug in Citrix, and they estimate that 80,000 corporate LANs were affected by this. Citrix, if you're not familiar, is an application that allows you to do things like remote desktop. It allows you to do application delivery, so you can like run a business application on your computer through Citrix. It turns out that there was a pretty big vulnerability there. If you are in a corporate space, you're going to want to know all about that one. I don't really interact with Citrix at this point in my career, so I don't have like a whole lot to say about that one. But the most interesting story of the day is Christmas malware. And this is from Sophos, and Sophos Labs, we reference them a lot here because they have some really great stuff that they do, really great research, and their articles are really great. Christmas malware uses support Greta Thunberg as a lure. So Greta Thunberg is now being plastered out there. If you're not familiar with who that is, Greta Thunberg is a environmentalist, a young lady, teenager, who is an activist for climate change. And essentially what happened was she's on the spectrum, and she was watching the TV as a child. And the TV, somebody said, you know, we really only have 12 to 15 years, and the whole world is going to become uninhabitable. It's all over. We have to do something. If we don't act now, the whole world is going to end as we know it. If you don't start recycling that plastic can and start using paper straws, it is over. The whole world is going to collapse. And we've got to change this, and we've got to do it now. And you can help by putting that metal can in the recycling bin that is appropriate for metal recycling rather than in the regular waste bin, because we wouldn't want that going to the landfill. We need to make sure that it goes to the proper place to be recycled. And that way, we will save the world. And we will not all die from rising sea levels. However, Greta Thunberg, upon hearing this news, went completely silent. The technical word here, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, the technical term here is dumb. That is, you can't speak. And so this is what happened. She went and lost her ability to speak. And she just stunned. And so now she can't talk. And for years, as I understand it, she was not able to say anything. And then finally, she's through therapy and all this, she starts to come out. And as she starts to be able to use her voice again to talk, she becomes an incredible advocate for climate change and for what we can do. We need to do something. So she's an activist. And really just a teenager still. But she's become a poster face for this movement of, climate crisis. So, over Christmas, there were pieces of malware that were spreading with spam emails and so forth, things that would say, like, please help save the planet. Greta needs your help. Support Greta Thunberg. And they would tout about an upcoming demonstration. However, you couldn't just see the demonstration. You had to guess it. Wait for it. Here we go. Open a Word document. That's what you had to do to learn about the demonstration. So when you opened that Word document, it would say Merry Christmas. And it would invite you to participate, and it would have macros and so forth, and then it would drop Emotet on your computer, which is a malware, and that was it. It was pretty straightforward. So now they're using Greta Thunberg as a way to get into people's computers and drop malware there and listen in, maybe steal your data, maybe steal your passwords, who knows what. There is, this is the time of year to have reviews of what happened in 2019. There's a really sad thing, and I want to start with this just because it's not going to get a lot of attention. I think it deserves a lot of attention. We've heard of Chicago. We know the numbers in Chicago. But big cities across America where there are Democrat strongholds and where there are gun safe zones and so forth are just full of crime, completely full of crime. Baltimore broke the record for their city in 2019 for the number of killings that happened in Baltimore. And as of Friday for 2019, their number was 342 in the year 2019. This beats the record. This is their record. The closest they've come to this was in 1993, which the number then was 353. People killed in 1993, and in 2019 we have 342, and that's the biggest number This is the fifth year in a row that Baltimore has reported more than 300 killings in a year. Before 2015, that number had generally been on the decline, but it reversed after civil unrest followed the death of the police custody of Freddie Gray. Remember Freddie Gray? When that incident sort of sparked all of this. And it's an indicator. And this is one of those areas where I think society is really changing in the United States. And we're seeing more and more of these killings and murders and mass shootings are on the rise. And we don't really understand what they are. It's because, I think, of our culture's shift away from the individual and our shift away from family. And there's a breeding ground of people who do not have the satisfaction of personal success and of the psychological implications of being liked and being able to be accepted into society. People are outcast more and more due to a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons. Technology is definitely a part of it. There are other parts of it. Our education system, the reversal of the paradigm of the family, where now the man is put down, the man is dumb, the man is not very smart, and all of these things. All of these are contributing factors. It's not like you can just flip a switch and say, well, this is why there are all these mass killings. One of the reasons is all of these social paradigms. Another reason is medication. As I understand it, most of these mass killings, which is not our story here today, but I'm on it, I might as well rant on about it. The medications that are being prescribed to people now today are really untested. A lot of these are unknown things. We think we know about the brain, but in our medical community today, it seems like people think that they know more than they really do. And I think the statistic was, if I'm not wrong about this, that something like 90% of the mass shooters in the United States have been on antidepressants of some kind. So, you know, I think there's a misconception, a misunderstanding about the medical industry that is a contributor to this whole problem. And I can't claim to be an expert in that, but it certainly concerns me that a statistic like that would exist and people would say, well, we're still going to continue to subscribe to prescribe these kinds of medications without further research. I think the loss of life of this caliber, of this extreme, is a big enough reason to ban a particular kind of drug until there's further research done. But that's my personal opinion about it. Wikipedia, on a brighter note, had a list of things that the internet wanted to know in 2019. So sort of a focus on their most hit pages. What do you think they were? Avengers Endgame tops the list in 2019 with 43 million page views. Deaths in 2019 was 36 million page views. Ted Bundy, 29 million page views. Freddie Mercury, 26 million. Chernobyl, 25 million. This was curious. Chernobyl is the documentary, well, the movie about it. There was a movie made about it. I forget when that came out. It might have been earlier this year. That was really inspiring to a lot of people to look into Chernobyl and find out about it, myself included. Over the summer, I watched it was a series. It was a long series. It was a lot of hours to watch, but it was very worth it. Very well done. Very accurate to the historical what actually happened. I mean, there were some minor changes to make it theatrical, but really great. Great movie, and it interested a lot of people. So it hit number 5 on the Wikipedia page of the year, was the Chernobyl disaster, not the movie, but the Chernobyl disaster. Because what happened was people watched the movie, and they wanted to learn about the disaster. They wanted to learn about the real thing. A good movie, especially one that's based on real life, will do that. It will cause people to do that. Joker, the film, hit number 7. List of the highest grossed films was, so people are really fascinated by movies, apparently. List of Marvel Cinematic Universe films was number 8. Well, there's something to learn there. People are interested in the virtual reality perhaps more than they are in the real reality. Interesting. Let's do some glimpse into the future. Let's do a little glimpse into the future. Let's see what 2020 is going to be about. I've got a couple of short stories to just quickly mention, and then we'll look at some predictions. NBC, the Peacock, NBC Universal is planning to launch a streaming service. Who isn't planning to launch a streaming service? NBC Universal is one of them. And their streaming service is, they are planning to launch in April. And the parent company is reportedly in advanced talks to buy an ad-supported streaming service, Xumo. So Xumo is going to be bought by NBC, or the parent company of NBC. Not sure how that works. And so that's a story, something to be aware of, that that's happening. I don't know how relevant it's going to be. We'll see what that looks like. I did switch to Disney Plus. In the first week of December, I said, I want to try this out. They had a trial. I said, I'll try it, right? Because I'm a Linux user, so I'll try the streaming service. We'll see how it goes. So I signed up. I logged into Disney Plus, and I got an error. And I said, well, maybe it's the browser. I switched browser, got it, same error. Looked up the error. Turns out they didn't support Linux at all. They were like, nope, we don't support Linux. Not supported. And that was the error, essentially, was that it couldn't render on Linux because of DRM, of course, from DRM. I thought, well, that's strange. Netflix and Amazon Prime and all of these other services are fine. Hulu's fine on Linux. What's the deal? Turns out I should have waited like 4 days because it was that Thursday, the first Thursday of December, that they announced that they were releasing a support for Linux. I was like, oh, really? So finally, last week, I broke down and went ahead and signed up. So I had seen one of my coworkers had opened up Chrome on Linux and logged into their Disney Plus account and said, here, look, it works. So I had evidence that it worked, so I knew it was going to work. So then I went ahead and bought it. Switched to it, and there's really a lot there. Disney's got a lot of content. I feel like the variety is still a little bit smaller than what's on Netflix, but it's a thing. I dropped Netflix for now because I don't see the point in having multiple streaming services. And this is one of the things that's going to happen now is you're going to have people competing for these different platforms. They're going to compete against each other, which is probably a good thing. I mean, it's capitalism at work. But anyway, rather than having one place to go to get all your content, you're going to have a lot of different places, and you're going to have to, like, pick them. So NBC is going to have their own streaming service. So anyway, that's a whole thing. Pelosi was commended by a Democrat for not handing the articles of impeachment. And this kind of gave me a glimpse into the beginning of 2020. We're going to see a lot of activity. Especially around the 7th, I think, is when the Congress gets back from their break. It's going to be a lot going on. And this is just a glimpse into what that might look like if Democrats are commending her for not handing it over because of a false sham trial. There is this small chance that she won't hand it over. And how glorious would that be? They impeach the president, and then they don't hand the articles to the Senate. And then Trump can say he wasn't impeached, and it's the whole thing. And, that could be interesting, for sure. Here's another story on ransomware. So ransomware is, again, where your files are encrypted on your computer. And in 2020... it's being predicted that we're going to start to see other techniques being used with ransomware. And there are some experts here that are predicting that
mobile devices are primed in 2020 to be the target of attacks now. And that was the thing that made me really curious. I was really curious for a while. I was like, okay, what is it with mobile devices that they're not getting hit with viruses and stuff? With computers, you had viruses. And then people got these smartphones that were just as capable of having of running viruses. And nobody was really getting viruses. There were viruses out there that you could get, but in general, they weren't really using you didn't get viruses. It wasn't a normal thing to happen. So ransomware is primed to do that. Now, I only have a few minutes left, and there's too many things to get to. I've got a couple of things. The one thing I want to do, definitely I got to talk about this, night drone flights over Colorado. There have been drones, mysteriously, that no one can figure out who they belong to, flying over rural areas of Colorado. Here's the interesting thing. It's not illegal. There's like, it's not just like three drones or something. It's 17 drones have been estimated to be flying over these areas of California with a 6-foot wingspan. So they're not like tiny little drones. These are, and they're systematically, what they're doing is they're systematically flying a grid pattern. They're flying a square. They'll fly one square and then they'll fly another square. And the FAA doesn't know who they are. The Air Force doesn't know who they are. The Drug Enforcement Administration doesn't know who they are. The U.S. Army doesn't know who they are. And the Phillips County Sheriff's Office can't explain where they're coming from or who's operating them. And they're curious. They want to find out who's operating them because what's happening is people are calling the police. They're saying, there are these drones. It's scaring people. The thing is, it's not illegal. They remain about 200 to 300 feet in the air. 500 feet is the FAA ceiling for drone flights. There's no requirement to file a flight plan if you're going to fly a drone. You have to have an FAA license to fly a drone. What might be potentially illegal is you're supposed to only fly within line of sight, and that's a vague thing. When, you know, drones are capable of flying much further than line of sight. So, with this many drones, the chances of them all being within line of sight of their operators is not that great. So that's something to really curious. If I hear any more, I will let you know. Drones are of particular interest to me, and I think I might just end up going long here on this segment. I really can't. I'll just have to cut some commercial time out because there's just too much to talk about to get it all in here, and I'm leaving stories behind. This is good. This is a good problem to have, I guess. It means that I'm this podcast is really helping me to grow as a person and grow in my communication skills, or maybe not. I don't know. Let me know what your thoughts are. How am I doing? Am I doing good or am I doing bad? I don't know. Drones are important to me because I've flown drones in the past, before the FAA regulated them at all. I don't have my FAA regulation, so I haven't flown since. But it took a long time for the FAA to figure out how to regulate drones. And I think they've done a good job. I think they've landed in a reasonable place. But it was really rough because what they would start to do, and the FAA really started to push the limits here because what they were doing was charging people with breaking the law when there weren't any laws to break because there was no regulation on drones. And they were treating drones as manned aircraft, and that's not how that works. I'm completely out of time, but I'm still going to talk about this just really quickly. There was a Chinese hacker group that was caught bypassing two-factor authentication. And I wanted to take a little bit of time to really dig into what two-factor authentication is. So for those of you that don't know what it is, in security, what we do is we have a password is something that you know. And when you authenticate, you have who you are, something that you know, and that will get you in. Now, there's a what we call a two-factor authentication, and that is something that you have. The idea of a two-factor is you have to have something, you have to physically have something in order to prove that you are who you say you are. So you log in, you put your username, that's who you are, you put your password, that's what you know, and you put your two-factor, that's something that you have. That's the thinking behind two-factor. However, that can be worked around, and apparently the state-sponsored group APT 20 in China has been, in the past 2 years, been using much quieter ways of attacks. They disappeared for a couple of years, supposedly, but now with this recent research, they have, from Foxit, they have resurfaced. And 2016 and 2017, they were much quieter, and no one really knew what they were up to. They were breaking in through JBoss Systems, which was a platform, I believe that's a firewall, could be wrong, sort of an enterprise platform for large networks. And so they were bypassing user accounts two-factor authentication. And there are different forms of two-factor authentication. This one was Secure ID, which is supposed to be like really, really secure. I mean, it does a calculation. You have to plug in a token and generate a valid two-factor code each time you try to log in. And apparently they had figured out how to generate their own valid two-factor codes. So this is just a kind of a scary thing. We're going to have to think about, in 2020, we're going to have to really think about how we assess two-factor authentication and the security of our accounts. And each two-factor method, like text messaging, is really not a great solution for two-factor. And other things are not a really great solution for two-factor. But we're going to have to really evaluate this as we try to secure our accounts and our networks and our users in 2020. And so, anyways, with all of that, and all of that said, there's so much more. I didn't even get a closing monologue in. But I think that 2020 is going to be a really, really great year. I wish you all the best. And thank you for listening. And have a great year 2020, year of clarity. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time. Special thanks to Freedomizer Radio for hosting this show live at freedomizerradio.com. Background music by SAVFK, available at soundcloud.com/SAVFK. Up next on Freedomizer Radio, Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory.